Tick, tick, tick. Each sweep of Big Tech's clock enhances corporate power, but his hands also sweep away more of our civil rights. At first, each new surge of artificial intelligence and robotic technologies can seem perfectly benign, even playful. Take Spot, the robotic four-legged doggy that actually has no spots, no endearing puppy eyes, can't bark, has no tail to wag, and is very undoggy. In fact, this electronic critter is rather creepily nightmarish, but it's marketed by cute videos, including one of Spot mixing margaritas. Admit it, that beats training your real dog to bring your slippers to you. But you can't just adopt a Spot at your local animal shelter. Each artificial canine, manufactured by Boston Dynamics, which is owned by Korean auto giant Hyundai Motor Company, sells for about $75,000. So who's buying them? Mainly such big corporate outfits as oil refineries, mining operations, and electric utilities that want an unblinking eye to monitor and record workers, visitors, protesters, and all others who approach their facilities. Just one more layer of our cycloptic surveillance society. But the point at which Spot loses all cuteness and turns into a menacing beast of authoritarianism is when it's turned into a police dog. There's been quite a public backlash, for example, against the Honolulu Police Department for deploying one of their robotic canines in a tent city for homeless people. In addition to outrage at the obvious class bias in sicking Spot on the homeless, the public outcry grew hotter when it was revealed that the police had used federal pandemic relief funds to buy their Spot. Corporate and government officials assure us that this latest tech marvel won't be used to spy on innocent people, be weaponized, or otherwise bite us on the butt. Trust us, they say. This is Jim Hightower saying no. The Hightower Radio Lowdown is brought to you by the Lowdown Happy Hour, live streamed from the Chat and Chew Cafe. Details at HightowerLowdown.org.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So one of the things I've often talked about is the fact that we've got too many rich people with nothing to do. In fact, our policy, our tax policies have given way too much to the well-heeled. And they usually use that wealth, well, in ways that aren't benefiting working people or society as a whole. And I look at this this latest proposal that's been moved, I guess back on August 9th, you had this billionaire, this venture capitalist, they call him, Timothy Draper, who filed a petition with the California Attorney General's office that he wants to ban all public sector unions. No more. You have no representation. You have no rights. I guess moving back to the days of patronage. This is a bad idea, but there's somebody out there pushing it, and someone with money out the you-know-what. And here to share some thoughts on, well, how this could play out, what this is, and why we should be opposed to it, not just in California, but all across the country. I've asked Steve Smith to come talk with us. Steve is the communications director for the California Labor Federation, californialabor.org, their website. Steve, thanks for taking time for us.
Great to be on the show again, Rick.
So walk me through this. This venture capitalist, this rich guy, has a little bit too much money that he knows to do what to do with, and he's gonna attack public sector workers.
Like a lot of rich guys in Silicon Valley, he does have too much money. Instead of spending it on going to the moon or wherever out in space, like some of the rich Silicon Valley guys, he's decided to spend his money attacking workers through this ill-advised ballot measure. And first off, I have to say, what he wants to do here is not weaken public sector unions. He wants to eliminate the right of any worker in the public sector. We're talking about teachers or firefighters, any worker in the public sector to join a union. That has never been done anywhere in the history of the United States or in the country right now. And, this is a far extremist idea. But we have to take it seriously because these guys in Silicon Valley, they're made of money and they could throw a lot of money into something like this.
Yeah, and this is even more extreme than Scott Walker's Act 10. This is more extreme than anything that we've seen to this point. And even the Janus decision, which just created a national right to work law. This is out and out banning it. This is saying that you as an employee and the employer cannot, under rule of law, ever agree to a contract. I think that's extreme in ways that just blow my mind.
Well, and that's how bold some of these folks who are attacking unions are getting. You know, they've had some success with attacks in public on public sector unions across the country, and now they're getting bolder. And they're taking on the state that has the most public sector workers in the entire country, California. We've got 1.3 million public sector workers in this state, Rick. And you know, this is the last bastion of really middle class work for some folks in communities since our manufacturing was traded away to China and other countries. You know, a lot of folks who want a middle class job, they become, you know, a worker in the public sector, whether it be a teacher or a firefighter, postal service worker, or something else. They're providing a service to Californians every day. And now you've got this rich guy, millionaire, coming along with an idea to strip them of that right.
What's interesting to me, Steve, and this goes back to when I was a younger man, just beginning working. The public sector was, you know, they were solid jobs. They were stable. They didn't pay an awful lot, but they had good benefits. They had good retirement security. It's what they were able to negotiate and keep. And they never really, you know, got the big money for their education level and their talent. But, you know, they had good benefits. They had job security. There were some good things there. But, you know, where I worked in the private sector, you made a lot more money. You had really good benefits. But as corporate America has destroyed the private sector and my ability to get those good jobs, now the public sector starts looking like, hey, these are good jobs. And they've created this kind of working class jealousy. I mean, I hear people talk about teachers, how they have health care and they've got retirement security that they don't have, as if that's something bad or something wrong. Instead of going, hey, how do I get that stuff back? There's this mentality out there that we should be taking it from those people because they shouldn't have it because I don't. You're going to have to fight against that, I think.
Yeah, no, we will. And you know, as you rightly pointed out, it all stems with corporate America's ability to undermine the American worker, to undermine the idea of having a good job in America. They've done that so successfully that now they're trying to turn workers against one another. And that's exactly what this measure and so many of the other attacks on public sector workers are about. You've got, you know, millionaires pulling the strings, trying to get workers fighting one another while they're reaping all of the profits. That's what's at risk here. That's what's at stake. And you know, we will fight tooth and nail to stop this effort cold, because we in California believe in the middle class. We believe that workers ought to be able to bargain collectively, ought to be able to stand together in a union to demand a fair share of what our economy produces. And we're not about to let any millionaire Silicon Valley extremists take that away from workers here.
And I see this as an opportunity. I see this as busy work. I see the reason that he's doing this is to keep unions spinning their wheels and just, you know, chasing their tails. But I see this as an opportunity, because labor never does, they've never done a good job. And please, I'm not stepping on your toes, but labor's never done a really good job of telling the story of average everyday workers. They've never done a good job of tooting their own horn and saying, yeah, we build better lives. You know, I tell the story all the time. I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. We were dirt poor. I now live in a neighborhood with doctors and lawyers. That's because of my union card. That's because of the contract that I've worked my entire working life under. And I think those stories need to be told. So I see this as an opportunity to bring those people out and say, no, this gave my family opportunities and it can give your family opportunities. So I see this as actually as a positive opportunity that brought on by this billionaire. Or am I wrong here?
No, I think you're exactly right. You know, as you mentioned, we spend a lot of time representing workers, empowering workers, not enough time really explaining to the public the value a union and a union job not only gives to an individual worker, but to a community, to a city, to a state. And this is an opportunity, again, for us to do that. You know, we've been leading a project at the California Labor Federation for the last decade where we've done research and training really focused on that one thing, how to tell the story about the value of a union, a value of a union job. And, you know, this, you know, for all the pain and difficulty that it will cause for us to fight this initiative, it gives us that very opportunity to tell those stories and we'll have a platform to do so. So, you know, there is always a silver lining. We're always looking for it. And that, I think, is a very good point, Rick.
But the great hope that I have out of this, because I think we're in a moment in history. I think we're in this. And I know I was hoping for this after the last calamity that we had when Barack Obama took over, when we were coming out of the Bush recession and all of that. I was hoping then. But I think right now is an opportunity to grow the movement, to organize more workers. So this seems to me to be the kind of perfect storm kind of moment where, yeah, we're going to tell these stories. We're going to fight back this ugly attack. But we're also going to organize more people, because right now, from the polling showing it, more people want to join and form unions today more than ever before. So there's multiple opportunities, I think.
Well, the hope is that this effort is going to backfire on Mr. Draper and the other Silicon Valley millionaires in a very big way, because we plan to do just that. We're going to tell a story about the value that unions bring to our communities here in California. And Californians will view this as an extreme effort, because that's exactly what it is. You know, he's taking away a right that every worker ought to have in America, which is to stand together in a union and collectively bargain with their employer. Public sector workers, that's the biggest opportunity for veterans in this country to have a middle class job. We've got literally hundreds of thousands of veterans in public sector work and members of public sector unions right here in California. And I'll tell you, they will be itching to tell their story when the time comes, because somebody's trying to take away that middle class lifestyle that they fought for. That they fought not only for themselves, but for our country for.
Yeah, you know, I think I've been to a number of states that have been long-term no rights at work states, places like Mississippi and Alabama. And I look at their teachers, I look at their public sector workers, I look at the people who do the jobs that help, and the wages that they're paid are poverty wages. And, you know, I look at a state like California where people make a good, honest living. And I would say, look, you know, this Draper guy and the people who are pushing this, they want Mississippi to be what California is. They want to make California Mississippi. And I hope that message gets out. And this is the perfect juxtaposition of, you got somebody firmly in the 1% of the 1% against everybody else.
Yeah. And this guy, Tim Draper, comes from old money. He has never gone a day in his life feeling the struggles that so many millions of workers feel every day, which is why those workers want to join a union. He's never had to go through that for a single minute in his life. And yet here he is ready to spend millions of dollars to take away that right from working people. It really is despicable.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that's always been interesting to me, and I have people who, you know, they're anti-union people, but they're small government. You know, we want less intrusive government. I always ask the question, you know, if you don't believe in government, you don't want government in your life, you don't want government dictating anything, and then why would you want the government to say what you as a working person and they as an employer can agree on? I mean, it's the perfect argument of saying, look, get government out of our lives, allow an employer and an employee to come to a relationship and sign a contract like every CEO has across this country that protects their rights, that protects their working conditions, that protects their future. What's the problem? And the problem is we've been led down this path that this is a political issue, that it's a right-left thing, and it shouldn't be. This is a working-class thing, and I think we need to reclaim that message.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, we have the highest favorability rating as unions that we've had in decades. And here in California, we know that a full three quarters of people under 35 view unions favorably. 70% of those say they'd join a union tomorrow if given the chance. People understand that they are not going to get their fair share relying on the generosity of a corporate CEO. They're only going to get that fair share if they have a voice, if they have a contract that puts it in writing, and that's exactly what a union does for them.
Yeah, the website californialabor.org. Go there for information. Last question I've got for you, because you know this is starting in California. If you don't crush it there, it will come across the country. And I think this may, in states that have referendum and initiatives and all of that stuff, I think this is going to come anyway, because it really is just about chewing up union resources. So organizers aren't going out organizing new places. This is just a billionaire with a lot of money to just, tank down a hole, just to keep labor chasing its tail, so we don't organize Silicon Valley and other places. But you got to fight the fight.
That's right. And not only do we want to crush this initiative, we want to make it backfire spectacularly on those millionaires that are bankrolling these things. So we can tell those stories, so we can create more power for workers through this campaign. That's going to be our goal.
So the marching order out of this is join a union. At least that's always my marching order, but that's the
Yep.
marching order.
That's exactly right.
Good stuff,
That's what we're
Steve.
going to be doing.
I appreciate the time. Always great having you on the program. Thanks so much. I hope you'll come back as this progresses. Keep us up to date on the messaging and the stories that you're going to tell. We absolutely want to be part of that. Appreciate the time, Steve.
Wonderful to be with you, Rick. Thank you so much.
Good stuff. Our good friend Steve Smith, Communications Director there at the California Labor Federation. Check out their website, californialabor.org. We'll get links out at thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1902. That was the day more than 100 trade union delegates representing thousands of working people in St. Paul, Minnesota, elected Charles James to be the president of the city's Trades and Labor Assembly. Virtually forgotten by history, James is considered to be the first African American elected to a city labor council anywhere in America. He was born in 1866 in St. Paul and began working as a leather cutter for local shoe manufacturers at age 15. This was at a time when most African Americans were excluded from skilled trades. His biographer, Dave Riley, asserts that it is unclear when James became involved in union politics and organizing. Shoemaking was the largest mass production industry in St. Paul, employing thousands. Riley notes that the Knights of Labor had been active in the city during the 1880s, and shoe workers were among the first to organize. By 1899, James had become the first president of a newly formed shoe workers union in Minneapolis, and helped to found three more locals in St. Paul. By 1902, James was well known and well respected throughout the Twin Cities as a strong union leader. He served three terms as president of the Trades Assembly and then as secretary for seven more years. Riley states that James continued as a full-time organizer and district business agent, traveling to cities across the Midwest to organize shoe workers. When he died in 1923, the Boot and Shoe Workers Union eulogized him in their national journal. Though James had been obscured from local labor history for decades, Riley and others have worked to write Charles James back into the history books.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So Texas Governor Greg Abbott has COVID. The guy who's saying, no, we don't need anything. No. The guy who got his vaccine, got them both, actually. The guy who evidently now that he's asymptomatic, they say, but he got the monoclonal antibody just in case, just to be safe. You know, the stuff Trump got. You know, the stuff rich people get. The stuff that us poor folks, no. And what was interesting is Texans for Abbott yesterday tweeted out a short video of the governor mingling with the Republican Club at Heritage Ranch meeting. So a whole bunch of old white people crammed together in this meeting. And my first thought was whole bunch of people prime age for COVID death. And my first thought was, so one, who gave it to Abbott? How'd he get it? Second, how many people did he infect? And how many of those people are going to get the special monoclonal antibody just in case? You know, my mind kept going in this place. How many of those people are vaccinated? How many of those people are going to die because they got to meet the sick governor? Because he protected himself. He got the vaccine. It's interesting how they do for themselves, but the heck with everybody else. Especially because you look at in Texas right now, 4 school districts have closed down because it's that out of control. Texas now has requested from FEMA 5 mortuary trailers. You know, those mobile morgues, you know, basically just refrigerated trailers that they turn into morgues so they can stack up all of the dead. Yeah. Florida, they already had their mortuary trailers. And now they've got more than 8,000 students who are isolated or quarantined because of the spike. And it's only been a couple of days that we're into the school year. That's it. But you got their governor. Don't worry about it. It's going to be fine. Things are going to be fine. On the federal level, the Transportation Security Administration, the TSA, they have said that masks will be mandatory on planes, buses, and trains until the new year, until January, I guess, 18th of 2022. I don't know why they picked an arbitrary day like that. Could be it's just a Monday. But that's the date that they're going to go with this. Now, they've said, look, you know, Biden has never relaxed this standard. We're going to be flying here in about a month and a half. Now, I'm hoping I'll be wearing my mask. I'll be doing the best I can to protect myself. But I'm looking at these moments and going, you know, all of these scenes you see on airplanes of people not remembering how to deal with other people, not being patient, not being anywhere near tolerant. The Karens losing their minds. And look, I understand it's been a tough year and a half. It really has. And it's because of the Abbotts and the DeSantises and their minions that this has gone on this long, that things are going to get bad again. And, you know, as I said, I have a listener who sends me all of these horrible models. And look, I'm not even smart enough to understand all of what they mean. All I know is they all look bad. The end of September, they're talking about, 300,000 infections a day? And but Rick, don't you know? They're not killing as many people. It's a lower death rate. I'll tell that to the hospitals that are full of people. And, the children don't get sick. The children, they get through it. But, you know, their beautiful smiles are covered up, and it's bad for who knows what. A couple of days I've spent, you know, falling down this rabbit hole of these parents who, you know, just 6 months ago couldn't do Common Core math, but now are all of a sudden, you know, figuring out how to do these models that tell them everything's going to be fine. We're all epidemiologists now. I'm dealing with people who barely got out of high school and out of high school biology telling me, no, it's all a conspiracy. Because I saw it on 4chan or QChan or Crazy Network or wherever these people get their news. I get emails from people all the time. A guy the other day said, you know, I found your show on the way from OAN to Newsmax. And I'm going, so you went from crazy to crazier? And somehow you stumbled on me and you think I'm the problem. I don't know how to help you. And the weird thing is they never want to have a conversation. They just want to attack. Never ask for, you know, resources, because they know. They believe. They're believers. As where I ask people who actually know. The people who've spent their lives studying this stuff. Me, I trust my doctor. I trust the people that I bring on this program who are doctors, who've spent their lives doing this stuff. And they all say the same thing. The only way we're getting through this, the only way this isn't going to continue to take us down, is if we get the vaccine, we do the social distancing, we wash our hands and get the grime off our hands, and we stay away from each other. Keep your distance. Now, look, you know, I've always been the social distance guy. You know, for me, I very early on, I learned personal space. I don't like people in my personal space. I won't get into your personal space. We'll be good. This is the time to maybe relearn that stuff. But I'm looking at Texas. I'm looking at Florida. I'm looking at these southern states where you're now having these big outbreaks. And you go, this was predictable. This was us. And, you know, if you're an outsider, and I know a lot of people don't care what the rest of the world thinks of us, but if you're an outsider looking into this country and you're going, you know, look how short-sighted they were on Iraq and Afghanistan. Look at how they had no interest in an actual discussion or debate, or it was all just shouting each other down. And now we are in this moment where just something as simple as covering your mouth has now become something that people want to literally fight each other over after school board meetings. There are literally brawls after school board meetings because someone says we should cover our pie hole. You know, I was talking to somebody today and, you know, I didn't have a mask on. We were far apart. We were outside. And, you know, I couldn't help but at one point notice that when I had said a word, something flew out of my mouth. And I'm going, you know, that's how it gets. That's how you get infected. That's what the mask is supposed to do. Stop that. Stop you from spreading all of that. Look, I'm not a doctor. I don't pretend to be. This is kind of common sense, though. And, you know, I remember a doctor we had on, I guess it's been about 6 or 8 months ago, who said, look, you know, we went through the flu season and I didn't get sick for the first time in years. I didn't get the flu. I didn't get anything. I'm dealing with all these sick people in the emergency room. I got nothing. And he goes, you know why I think it was? Because we weren't swapping germs. You kept your germs. I kept my germs. We didn't swap them. I didn't get sick. He said, and I quote, I'm probably going to wear this mask forever. His choice, good on him. But in this moment, don't you think just a little common sense, a little logic? I don't know. Love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back. Stick around.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
The earthquake could not have come at a worse time. Haiti is in the midst of a political crisis and is being threatened by a tropical storm, which could bring heavy rains and mudslides to the already crippled nation.
Tropical depression Grace compounds disaster as Haiti reels from powerful earthquake. July 2021 was the hottest month ever recorded on planet Earth. Plus,
climate change science is telling us some really stark truths about the decline of water here in the western United States.
Federal government declares water shortage on the Colorado River for the first time ever.
All of those declarations and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
They passed a $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill. To put that into perspective, if you took 1.2 trillion $1 bills and laid them end to end, they'd make better roads than what we're driving on right now, which is why we need the bill.
This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, as if things weren't horrific enough in Haiti, now they're slammed by a tropical depression.
Indeed. On Saturday, a 7.2 magnitude earthquake hit western Haiti, still not fully recovered from the devastating 2010 earthquake, also struggling with the pandemic, gang violence, and political chaos after its president was assassinated last month. Now a tropical storm is plunging the poorest nation in the western hemisphere even further into crisis. As we go to air, more than 1,400 people are confirmed dead, thousands more injured, tens of thousands rendered homeless and in immediate need of shelter, food, clean water, and medical care. The region is in desperate need of assistance, but compounding the devastation is Tropical Depression Grace. The storm's track is almost right over the epicenter of the earthquake and is forecast to dump as much as 15 inches of rain in some areas. This is a harrowing example of what emergency management experts call a compound disaster. Natural disasters hitting in quick succession, pushing government response and infrastructure resilience to the breaking point.
And that's something that you have warned about for years, having more than one disaster at a time. And Haiti has, well, now at least more than one disaster.
Meanwhile, July 2021 was Earth's hottest month ever recorded globally since record-keeping began in the 1880s. That's according to NOAA, breaking the previous record set just last year. July saw two flood disasters in China and Germany that each cost more than $25 billion in damages. The month also saw the hottest reliably recorded temperature for the planet, an astonishing 130 degrees Fahrenheit at Death Valley, California. It is not a good sign that this new all-time hottest month record is occurring when there is no El Nino weather pattern in the Pacific to blame for goosing global temperatures.
So everything could be worse this month had there been an El Nino this year.
Exactly.
Oh, brother.
Japan is the latest country to see record-setting torrential rains. Parts of western Japan have set new, all-time highest rainfall records. Some areas deluged with 3 months' worth of rain in 24 hours. One prefecture saw more than 3.5 feet of rain in 3 days. Those have generated extreme floods and landslides that have collapsed buildings and swept away homes. Here in the U.S., the Biden administration on Monday formally declared a water shortage on the Colorado River for the first time in U.S. history amid a decades-long mega drought that experts say is a sign of what is to come with man-made climate change. The river's main reservoirs have dropped to new historic lows. Lake Mead near Las Vegas is at 35% capacity, Lake Powell at 32%. Both are still falling, triggering the first ever mandatory water cuts in the Southwest. Starting next year, Arizona will lose almost 20% of its river allocation.
Wow.
Nevada will lose about 7%. In an interview with KUNM, John Fleck, director of the Water Resources Program at the University of New Mexico, warns that further cuts are likely and communities should begin preparing now for even worse.
They won't.
Coping with less water is a permanent phenomenon. We cannot expect wet times to return.
So this is a problem for drinking water, for farming, and how about for power?
There are concerns about that as well from the hydroelectric plants at Lake Mead and the Hoover Dam,
which is at an all-time low.
Yes. In Northern California, new evacuations have been ordered as the relentless Dixie Fire shows no signs of slowing down more than a month after it ignited near a Pacific Gas and Electric power station. Fire experts warn that it now appears that giant infernos that burn for months on end are the new norm for California. Finally, a bit of good news. The Biden administration is moving to restore even more of the Trump administration's dismantling of efficiency standards for appliances, which, by the way, most manufacturers did not support and did not request. For light bulbs, dishwashers, clothes washers, and shower heads, which save consumers both money and water, particularly crucial amid the Western drought.
For much more on all of those stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So you look at all the craziness that's going on, and look, Florida is in the heart of insanity, and it's going to be... look, my wife and I have taken the kids down to Florida for Christmas for, you know, multiple years. Not the last two, of course, but for, you know, several years before that. That was our Christmas present. We always went down, spent 2 weeks on the beach, a good family event. I don't know when we're going back with as crazy as things are and really how unserious the leadership there is. So the only way to change that is to change the leadership. The only way to change the culture is to get the bums out who are causing this mess, which is why I think it's important to get local people to run for office and take on those entrenched interests. And here to share some thoughts on why she's decided to run in Florida's 19th Congressional District. I've asked Cindy Beignet to come back and talk with us. She is a university professor and, look, someone who's willing to step forward and say, things are wrong and actually know how to fix them. Cindy, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me, Rick.
So you literally teach American government.
I do. I teach American government, helping to have the next generation of youth be informed on how our government works and to get excited to get involved.
Yeah, I looked at, with what's going on in Afghanistan right now, I look at this special report that just came out talking about what lessons did we learn from Afghanistan by this special counsel guy. And one of the things that they said is the mission was always doomed from the beginning because, well, short-term thinking, hubris, and bad intelligence. Basically, us... Our arrogance and our stupidity caused this.
Yeah, so we know that Afghanistan was going to be a problem. It was a knee-jerk reaction in this formulated war against terror under Dick Cheney's, you know, doctrine to just do a bait and switch, essentially, from the Cold War to the war on terror. And it met those needs at the time, but there was urging from a lot of people from the very beginning to not let it go on forever, to have an exit strategy, to not let this become the next Vietnam. And here we are evacuating just like we did in Saigon.
No, and that's the thing that's most frustrating about this. But again, I keep coming back to it's us. We're not the educated populace. We like to pump up our chest and think we are, because most people don't even remember that it was Bush that got us into this mess.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, and somebody like me who's got 2 degrees in international relations and has worked in foreign policy a lot, it pains me that Americans don't pay attention to foreign policy. I know they don't. They care about the veterans and the soldiers coming back and the experience they had, but they really didn't care about why we were there in the first place. And the unfortunate thing was, is it started as a war on terror and then moved into this neoconservative boondoggle of nation building where we actually had the soldiers doing the nation building, and that was never going to work.
Yeah, but I still don't know why we were there. I don't know how you have a war on a frame of mind. I don't know how you I thought we were there to go kill bin Laden. I didn't realize that there was anything. We wanted blood. We wanted retribution. And our leaders failed us at the time and have failed us all along, which is why it would be nice to have somebody who at least understands foreign policy, at least understands how government can and should work. Seems kind of sane and rational to me.
Yeah. You know what? I really wish that we could have made Afghanistan a modern democracy. I do. I love the concept of it. But you cannot make that happen overnight. And no amount of dollars was going to make that happen in Afghanistan. And we knew from the very beginning that the Taliban was always going to be playing a waiting game. They could wait us out. They'd live there. Their families live there. And we were going to have to leave at some point. And that's all they did. They just waited us out and they came back in. And we had no idea why we were going there in the first place, in a very real sense. And neither did the soldiers.
Yeah. But the thing is, we were there 20 years. You go 20 years, you should have done something. And you look at what happened yesterday. You know, it basically was just, okay, 20 years down the drain, because the army that we were supposedly building up and training and arming and doing all this stuff just said, okay, we give up, and then handed over all the stuff that we gave them, which again was predictable. I had people 10 years ago saying they're never going to fight.
Right. And also, you know, the Taliban did work in building relationships in these communities, and they had that capacity to do so. One thing that Americans don't really like to talk about, you know, now we're talking about, oh, the Taliban's going to come back and they're going to be so bad for women. Okay, but do we really know who our allies were there? Pashtun warlords across Afghanistan had significant issues with pedophilia, taking young boys as sex slaves. Those were the American allies in a lot of cases. Soldiers were told to look the other way when those types of atrocities were happening on military bases even. And the Taliban actually got their start fighting against those very warlords to keep young boys from being sexually enslaved by these warlords. And for me, it's just a complete lack of understanding of the cultural situation there and trading one bad for another, honestly.
Absolutely. But that is American foreign policy right there. And as I said earlier, I think what happened in Afghanistan is exactly what was supposed to happen. The American taxpayer got fleeced by corporate America. There were massive profits for our wealthy. And, well, a bunch of soldiers got killed. There was a bunch of people who got injured, but that it was worth it for the profit. To me, that's the underlying part of this, and which is why I want people in Congress who are going to be much more judicious before sending our young men and women into harm's way.
Absolutely. It's not a mistake that Dick Cheney was the one that championed this and that his daughter Liz Cheney is continuing to champion the engagement there. And it's because of their connections with Halliburton. It's the military industrial complex making billions of dollars off the taxpayer, you know, payroll. And they don't want that to end. And it's pretty obvious and it's pretty sad. And you're right. The people who paid the most for it, aside from the American taxpayer, are the people who paid with their lives and their sanity for being sent over there.
Yeah, no, we could talk about this all night, but I want to get to why you're running, because I'm always interested in why people are willing to throw themselves in the middle of the fishbowl and take the abuse and take the beatings that come with running for political office. So why are you jumping in the middle of this again?
Again, well, so I'm somebody who's used to taking a punch. I used to be a professional boxer, so you know, taking a few hits and getting back up—that's nothing new to me. And one of the reasons I decided to run before and again is to fight the corruption. I was working behind the scenes as a consultant doing reports for nonprofits and government agencies, and I saw a lot of corruption that people just shrugged their shoulders and said, this is the way it is. And I'm here to say that it's not. I want to end the corporate take. I want to end the backroom deals. I want the people to be first in what our government does. And that's why I'm running for Congress.
Yeah, I go back to what I said about, you know, Afghanistan doing exactly what it's supposed to, which is to make more money for the very wealthy. And you're spot on. The moneyed interests of this country always come first. They always lobby themselves the best deals, the best opportunity, the lowest tax rates, all of that, while the rest of us suffer with lower educational opportunities, less healthcare opportunities. I mean, I look at what's going on in Texas right now with the governor there, who now evidently is asymptomatic with COVID, and they gave him this monoclonal antibody that virtually nobody else gets because it's expensive and it's hard to get. He got it just in case.
Just in case. Well, you know, the thing that's been trending on Twitter is Regeneron Ron DeSantis, right? Because apparently his wife has some stakes in the company that makes that, and he's trying to promote that same treatment here in Florida. And it's really crazy to me that we're talking about treating an illness instead of preventing it. Because isn't prevention a big deal when we can wear masks and get people vaccinated instead of, you know, having brouhahas and pretending like it's a hoax? I mean, people are dying. We had a major restaurateur in our area die just yesterday, and a lot of people are very sad about that. And, you know, he was a denier and a big Trump supporter, and, you know, he took his life into his own hands because he was misled by people like Ron DeSantis and Abbott in Texas.
You know, I want to say that's sad, but I got to be honest at this point, if you've put yourself into that, and I know it's bad for my soul and it's bad for my karma, but, you know, that was your choice. You know, goodbye. Because we used to know, I mean, Ben Franklin told us, ounce of prevention worth a pound of cure. We used to know this stuff. This used to be common sense. What happened?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, I know one of my best friends is a nurse, an ICU nurse up in Detroit. And she was telling me as early as February and March of this year that her and her colleagues were getting tired of seeing people who should have been vaccinated keep coming into the ICU. So I feel for those folks who are working in our healthcare industry. All of our hospitals are getting to capacity. Their patients is wearing very thin when people can do very simple things to protect themselves from getting sick.
Yeah, and what's concerned me throughout this pandemic is that eventually you're going to burn out those healthcare professionals and we're going to be left with nothing. I mean, I look at the states who are already overrun with their facilities, but I'm waiting for the day where people just go, you know what, I'm not doing this anymore.
And walk out, you know, right? You know, I think the healthcare industry is poised to be one of those places where there's going to be the great resignation, right? We're seeing that shift in multiple industries across the United States. And yeah, people, they've had hiring issues here in Southwest Florida for a very long time. We always are at a deficit with our healthcare workers, actually. And this is putting a huge stress on them. People are working extra hours. And we're at the point where they are asking people not to come into the ER because it's so backed up with the COVID patients.
It's crazy. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Cindy Binier. She's running for Congress in Florida, the 19th Congressional District there. Make sure you check out her website, cindybinier.com. We'll get links out on social media how you can do that. You know, we've been talking about all the things that are wrong. You know, what are we going to do to turn this around? How do we use our government to turn this thing around? I mean, for generations now, we've been bashing government's ability to do anything. We've got corporate America telling us that government's bad, everything should be privatized. You know, how do we turn all of this horrible around?
That's simple, actually. Investment. Because what you just said right now is that's the far right trope on government. Big government is bad. We defund the government. Then the government doesn't work and it fulfills itself. The prophecy fulfills itself, right? So if we actually make investments in things that the American people need, like healthcare, like family paid leave, like environmental protections, then government will work, right? Also, if we stop putting additional means testing in there, because that actually gums it down. So when we have all these preconceived ideas about who is worthy of accepting help or needing help, that makes it harder for government to do its job. So I'm somebody who's worked in efficiency and effectiveness, and I'm looking to take that to the American government.
And I think, you know, you're right about the means testing thing, because the one thing that came out of this pandemic so far is that government intervention works. Yeah. I mean,
it does. Investment works.
Yep.
We are not in the dire straits of the economic crisis like we were last year because we did the right thing with our fiscal policy, which is make sure that people are staying in their homes, make sure people are fed, make sure that people have the capacity to have a disruption in their work and not lose their house and not be able to feed their family, that we are helping small businesses get back on their feet. That's very, very simple government expectations. And it's crazy that people who say that they value the economy like conservatives are so willing to throw it under the bus when we need it most.
Yeah, I don't know that there are any true conservatives left. What we have are corporatists and Trumpites. And the person that you're running against is Byron Daniels, is one of two African-American Republicans in Congress, big Trump supporter, almost buddies, I guess. How does that play in your district?
Well, it's very interesting. Our district is gerrymandered to be a red-leaning district. But I am very proud to say that in our 2020 race, we were one of only five districts in the state of Florida to move in the Democratic direction. And we did so at the cheapest rate in the state of Florida. So we had a really amazing grassroots organization that helped move votes. And it's all about winning hearts and minds, because you're right. People who think that they might be conservative by principles have the wool pulled over their eyes with these corporatists and these Trump supporters.
No, and it's something that, you know, you've got to fight in these more right-leaning rural maybe areas, because look, the policies are right. The policies are popular. You start talking about the investments in infrastructure and education and healthcare. This is almost nonpartisan, or at least it should be. But we've been trained like Pavlovian dogs to, you know, we got to be in our camps. I'm on the red team. You're on the blue team. And never shall we agree on anything. And at some point, we got to break that down.
Yeah, I agree. You know, it's new identity politics. And, you know, being a Republican, being the Trump supporter, that's an identity. And what's interesting, if you look at what people really believe. So in our district, the $15 minimum wage amendment that was in Florida passed by 64%. Now, if each one of those people had actually voted for the candidate, me, who believes in having a $15 minimum wage, having a living wage, having a job guarantee, then I would have won the election, right? But they voted for the person who didn't believe in that. So there's a very big disconnect between what people really want and need and what they think their government officials that they're electing are going to deliver for them.
Now, let me ask you last line of questioning. What is the one issue that Cindy Beignet thinks is the hill you die on? I mean, everything else you could compromise on. What's that one hill that you die on?
Healthcare. For me, healthcare is very personal. My youngest daughter had a rare blood disease. And when she was going to the hospital in the ambulance for the very first time, rather than calling anybody in my family, the first phone call I made was to the insurance company. Because I wasn't sure how much an ambulance trip was going to cost, but I knew it wasn't what I had in my bank account. And I don't believe that it's right for any parent to be going bankrupt to save the life of their child. So I'm going to be fighting to make sure that we have access to affordable care that works. I am a proponent of universal health care. And I think that we need to keep making strides towards that, because that is what kids like my daughter Evie need, and what everybody else in this country needs to be healthy, safe, and productive in their own right.
When you say universal health care, there's a lot of definitions being thrown around of what universal or single payer is. Single payer being the Medicare for all. Universal, in my definition, being kind of like the military's TRICARE, owned by the government, run by the government. Is that where we're talking? Where do you find yourself on that spectrum?
So I usually talk about modeling a system of care based on the Japanese model. That's where I did my university studies there, and it works really well. They have some of the best healthcare outcomes in the world. They have cost fixing. Prices are fixed in the same way that we have Medicare and Medicaid prices that are fixed, and everybody is on a sliding scale based on what they can pay to buy into that system. So it is a national healthcare plan. It is tailored to what people need, and it will make sure that people don't go bankrupt.
Yeah, I mean, it's disgraceful. And like you said, I've been fortunate. I remember my daughter broke her arm, and as I'm driving her to the hospital, I wasn't thinking of which hospital is going to give me the best deal. I was thinking, how can I get to the closest hospital, get her the care that she needs? And fortunately, I never worried about bankruptcy or any of that, because my union fights for the best health care that we're going to get. And I say all the time, our union should run the country's health care, because we get fantastic care. when we need it. And I want that kind of security for everyone. So I'm glad to hear that you've got an idea and you want to move us in a positive direction. I want people to check out the website, CindyBenier.com. What can we do to help?
Send money. That's what grassroots candidates need. I would love for you. You can find me on ActBlue, CindyBanyai. If you'd like to volunteer, share, retweet my stuff, share my links on Facebook and Twitter. All of that stuff helps a grassroots candidate. $5, $10. Every little bit matters. And I love to have support. I love to hear from folks. So go ahead and reach out. I'm here.
Good stuff. Cindy, I appreciate the time. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again as this continues.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Rick.
Great having you back. CindyBenier.com, the website. Maybe help out where you can. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1985. That was the day that workers at the Hormel plant in Austin, Minnesota, went out on strike. They were members of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, Local P9. Hormel had slashed workers' wages by 23% during the early 1980s. Benefits were also diminished and incentive programs rolled back. These changes cut deeply into the Hormel workers' earnings. What had been considered a good job was changing drastically. This was the story for many workers in Reagan-era America. The 3,500 Hormel workers voted overwhelmingly to strike. The National UFCW discouraged the action. The strike lasted more than a year. Strikebreakers were brought in, including some of the union members who crossed the picket line to return to work. The National Guard was called in to keep the peace between strikers and the scabs. After a year, the strike went down in defeat. Even after the strike, many of the workers were not called back to work. They were put on waiting lists for a job to reopen. Some never returned to the plant. 25 years after the strike, the Austin Daily Herald staff wrote, quote, "What resulted was a bitter, drawn-out labor dispute that drastically impacted the community, from workers who lost their jobs to families that were torn apart by the picket lines." The strike became the feature of a documentary by Barbara Koppel. In 1990, the documentary American Dream won the Academy Award. The film tells the story of the Hormel strike as a window into the tragic experiences of many workers during the 1980s. The film was made on a shoestring budget. Singer Bruce Springsteen provided $25,000 to help support this important film. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I'm actually pretty happy to see this. Evidently, two former police officers from Rocky Mount, Virginia, they have rejected the plea agreement with the Department of Justice after they broke into our Capitol with the other treasonous thugs. They were charged with obstructing an official proceeding, as well as another charge of violent entry and disorderly conduct. They have rejected the agreement, and it doesn't say what that was. I gotta imagine it was a slap on the wrist and a couple $100 fine. But no, they do not. They do not want to go forward with the deal. And my thought is, good. Fight that, because I want to see the trial. I want to see the maximum penalty. I want someone made an example of. I want these guys to go. No. I want them to go to jail. One of them was a corporal in the National Guard. Hoping for jail time. Anyway, if you missed any of today's program, therickssmithshow.com. That's where you go to get the podcast, The Rick Smith Show app on the smartphone. Take the program on the go wherever you go. And as always, you can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back in the next one.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At rick@therickssmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.